preponderance in some function of man's composite constitution. The studious seeker after the keys to the hidden work will do well to take the whole body of symbolism and ritualism and attempt to discover their correspondences in the workings of his own parts and members. Salvation is not alone a matter of theology nor yet a matter of philosophy, it is a matter of science and of sciences, particularly the concern of biology. Biological salvation is a formidable term, yet it underlies the whole theory of religion, for the redemption of the human race cannot be achieved spiritually until each individual has come to understand the relationship between all his parts and is instructed in the proper manner of combining his forces and resources. Man is therefore the quintessence of all the elements, writes Paracelsus, and a son of the universe or a copy in miniature of its soul, and everything that exists or takes place in the universe, exists or may take place in the constitution of man. The congeries of forces and essences making up the constitution of what we call man, is the same as the congeries of forces and powers that on an infinitely larger scale is called the universe, and everything in the universe reflects itself in man, and may come to his consciousness, and this circumstance enables a man who knows himself, to know the universe, and to perceive not only that which exists invisibly in the universe, but to foresee and prophesy future events. On this intimate relationship between the universe and man depends the harmony by which the infinite becomes intimately connected with the finite, the immeasurably great with the small. It is the golden chain of Homer, or the Platonic ring, concerning the spiritual agencies which actuate the vast side real order we are still comparatively ignorant in its quest. Science classifies phenomena but senses few of the motives of which phenomena are but the transitory expression. We recognize an infinite life manifesting through an all-powerful urge, which, communicated to universal bodies, hurls them with great violence through the definitionless vistas of space. We sense yet cannot fully comprehend the stupendous agency. APHILOSOPHICCONSIDERATIONOFMAN 401. 402 LECTURESONANCIENTPHILOSOPHY. Which orders the infinite diversity of existence. Still it profits us nothing to contemplate this infinite magnificence, for recoiling from the unimaginable the mind is sickened by the awesomeness of cosmic magnitudes. Each new discovery but complicates the issues. Men grow tired of the vain quest for ultimates, and with a certain measure of relief draw their shrouds about them and turn from the whole uncertainty. Life becomes a period of vain searching in which the mind, certain beforehand that it shall not achieve its goal, struggles against its own convictions for a little while. The materialist is not really disappointed when failure rewards his efforts. For down in his very heart he really expected disappointment, and would have been genuinely surprised with any other result. The most the uninitiated can hope to accomplish is a certain classification of the problems of the unknown whereby futurity may receive the answerless queries of the past in orderly form. The astronomer is equipped with the finest instrument that genius of man can produce. Gazing into the starry night through a 40-inch refractor, the pageantry of stars that moves across his field of vision is brought a little nearer, but their mystery is only compounded by their proximity. How can a man, even though long tutored in the science of the heavens, sense the motives of these distant spheres when the very blades of grass outside his observatory door and within the grasp of his hand are a mystery equally unsolvable? If a philosopher should enter that observatory and say to the aged astronomer, "Your quest is in vain, no lens ever ground by mortal hand can discover the souls of the stars, the scientist would answer. I know that, but how else can I seek? I am born of a race that desires to know, and I must search, for only by this vain endeavor can I satisfy that inner urge. Scientists are men of a race apart, a definite mental species. We are eternal questioners, servants to an unfulfillable desire. The philosopher might smile and make reply, the urge to know is proof of the power to know, for the mind does not seek that which is incomprehensible, but is ever attempting to manifest in its outer functions that knowledge which is inseparable from its inner nature. The knowledge you desire is achievable, and you are divided from it only by your method of approach. Imagine that instead of this telescope, the inanimate product of mechanical skill, you possessed a living lens by which the stars could be brought closer to you than your very self. Do you not realize that you yourself are a telescope, and that by looking through your own being you can discover the SCCRCTS that lurk upon the very boundaries of space? Your own composite nature is a living instrument by whose virtues you partake of the sun, the moon, and the stars. Your soul is of the very stuff which lights the stars, and by virtue of these in you and yourself in them, their secrets are comprehensible to you. The life that actuates your own parts is a measure of that universal life, and the form that renders all these intangible agents perceptible to the outer senses is one with the spirit of form, whether it exists in the earth or in the sky. If you would understand universal mysteries, you must realize that only through the living instruments that have united to form your own being are the divisions of cosmic life rendered perceptible. Turn from your telescope, which can show you little more than your own unaided eye and will but confuse your already tired brain. Turn to the analysis of your own nature, the manifold parts which unite to form your wholeness, for by learning to know the mystery of your own being, you will come to understand the wonders of the all. Man's only hope of knowing is vested in himself. The creative ingenuity which continually manifests in the development of the arts and sciences discloses, in some measure, man's indwelling divinity. Though comparatively insignificant, the individual is nevertheless a creature with awareness and the capacity for infinite realization and understanding. While in magnitude he verges toward the inconsequential, in potentiality he inclines toward universal immensities. It is irrational, therefore, to judge humanity by the measure of its outward stroke tour. Rather, we must sense through unfolding superphysical faculties the spiritual sufficiency of that inward part from which the visible man is suspended. Man is the magnificent atom. APHILOSOPHICCONSIDERATIONOFMAN 403. 404 LECTURESONANCIENTPHILOSOPHY. Which baffles estimation and defies analysis. The universe, in turn, is the magnificent man, one of that race of giants by whose assembly space is rendered populous. Mortals congregate to form communities, these universal beings congregate to form clusters and galaxies of stars. It has been said that men are the shadows of the gods. The simile is most poetic, but man is more than this, for the shadow is substantial, and to it divinity has imparted something of itself that the likeness may share the virtues of the original. The life of the aspiring disciple is forever flowing toward his Father God, that radiant star whose light shines clearly and steadily throughout eternity. Man is forever seeking to escape from his own littleness and return to that greatness which abides in space. The soul springs from a race of giants and yearns for the strength of its progenitors. Man's throne is in the heavens, and he longs for the day when, entering into his own right, he shall seat himself with the immortals. All this we must remember when, gazing upon the mortal stature, we are led to erroneously conceive man to be a creature of flesh and bone and ignore his reality as a vast being fashioned from the stuff of aspiration. Man may be likened to a walled city standing on the edge of the desert. In the midst of the city is a well, and from it lead the roads which pass through the gates of the city and become the routes for caravans. The walled city finds its analog in the body, the gates with their dusty trails are the senses, and the well springing up in the midst of the city is the ever-flowing life by which both the community itself and the wandering caravans are nourished and sustained. Man's personality conceals his inner life as effectively as the cold, gray battlements of a fortified town conceal the bustling community that lies behind it. When we see only the physical nature of the individual, we behold that which least adequately expresses, and often most misinterprets, the internal qualities. Hence the disciple of the ancient wisdom is taught to realize that man is not essentially a poor sonality, but a spirit. His outer parts are not the measure of his inner virtues, but contribute that weakness of the flesh which all too often brings to naught the willingness of the spirit. The body can never know the noble ideals which impel the spirit toward accomplishment. Digestion and assimilation are the concerns of the body, to such homely ends it concerns its endeavors. Above the provinces of instinct and sensation come the concerns of the rational life. The Greeks gloried in their ability to become rational animals, for man is a rational animal. However, that which is rational and that which is animal are actually two definitely divided natures. Rationality is natural to transubstantial organisms, but is contrary to the moods of matter. Unless the rational part retires from its own body and meditates alone, it cannot escape the chidings of the flesh. Now this separation was accomplished by means of the fourth dimensional, or qualitative, interval. Seated in the midst of his disciples, the ancient philosopher, unheeding the nagging demands of the body that disturb the equilibrium of the rational soul, discoursed at length upon the verities of the intellectual life, regarding his physical vehicle as an organ of expression, a temperament suitable for communication, a structure which focused intellect and thus rendered its findings communicable. The true philosopher maintains the efficiency of his inferior nature not because he is a servant to its dictates, but because his own creative expression is dependent upon the physical nature for concrete organization and tangibility. Thought is the compensation of the original thinker. In matters of the mind, as in matters of finance, man is paid for what he gives, and owes for what he gets. No creative mind can be underpaid, for thought is its own reward and comes as adequate compensation for rational endeavor. Enriched by his own activities, the philosopher soon becomes fabulously wealthy in that most priceless of all possessions, reason. On the other hand, he who listens to the thoughts of the wise is daily contracting new debts, and the longer he listens, the poorer he becomes. This may explain why disciples seldom surpass their masters, unless, as Aristotle, they depart from the master's premises. Men eagerly frequent the assemblages of